Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hol dir zum Deutschlandspiel einen Big Mac für nur 1,24 Euro. Nur in deiner McDonald's-App. Beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Nur für registrierte App-User an Aktionstagen in teilnehmenden Restaurants.
Hello, I'm James Reynolds. Welcome to The Documentary from the BBC World Service. In BBC OS Conversations, we bring people together to share their experiences. And this time, we discuss Hajj, after more than 1,300 people died during an intense heat wave in the Saudi city of Mecca. It is a main pillar of the Islamic faith, a pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia that all Muslims must attempt, if they're able, at least once during their lifetime. In today's edition, three people share their own experiences. One of our guests was 8 months pregnant, but the chance to go to Mecca wasn't something that she was going to turn down.
There were elders who had literally saved for 40 years to be able to make Hajj. The experience made me feel closer to God, more firm in my faith, and also a lot more patient.
Each year, Muslims travel from all over the world to the holy city of Mecca, which they consider to be one of the most sacred places on earth. And this year, Saudi Arabia says 1.8 million people took part in the annual pilgrimage. It coincided, though, with a heat wave where temperatures reached over 50 degrees Celsius. Because of this, 1,300 people died, many of those because of that intense heat. Saida's parents, who lived in Maryland in the United States, were among those who lost their lives. She's been speaking to the BBC.
This is something they've wanted to do their entire lives. So the fact that they finally got the opportunity to complete it, they were just beyond excited. A lot of the things that were promised to them weren't provided. A lot of the transportation wasn't provided. They went a few days with having to find food for themselves, even though the package was supposed to come with all-inclusive everything. But it got to a point where they had to buy a rice cooker, and some of the people on the group just came together to make food for themselves. My mom, the last message she told me, she actually missed my call, then I missed her call. And she texted me and she said, "I'm so sorry, my love. We've been walking for over 2 hours since you texted us," shaking my head. And that was the last message my mother ever sent me. The Consulate General Office advised us that they were able to locate the name of the cemetery, but they aren't able to tell us exactly where in that cemetery they were buried. So no plot numbers. The day that they were actually buried is the unknown. They don't have their personal effects that were on them at the time of death, their passport, their cell phones. So just a lot of questions, and we're looking to find some answers.
Our condolences, of course, to Saida and her family. Permits for the Hajj pilgrimage are allocated on a quota system to every country and distributed by lottery. However, others try to take part without a permit. Saudi Arabia's health minister said that 80% or so of those who died in the pilgrimage this year were unregistered. Many were elderly. Many had long-term illnesses. Almost half of those who lost their lives were believed to be from Egypt and Indonesia, Pakistan, Malaysia, Jordan, Iran, Senegal, Sudan, and Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region all confirmed deaths. Within days of the incidents, Egypt and Jordan responded by taking action against tourism companies who were accused of issuing unofficial visas. And of course, a consequence of the unofficial route is that pilgrims don't have access to cooling facilities such as air-conditioned tents and buses. They have to get by in the heat if they can. And it should be pointed out that heat-related deaths have happened at Hajj for many hundreds of years, but conditions this year were described as unprecedented. And the whole Hajj, like the other voluntary pilgrimage, the Umrah, involves plenty of rituals held outdoors in the heat under the sun. There's the Tawaf, for example, the repeated walking around the holy stone building known as the Kaaba in the centre of the Al-Haram Mosque. We wanted to hear more about the experience of pilgrims, so we brought together three of them. Angelica lives in Arizona in the United States, and two men, each of them are called Ahmed, but I promise you it's easy to work out one from the other. One's from Kenya, the other's based in the United States but grew up in Saudi Arabia. And the first voice you'll hear is that of Ahmed, with his base in the US, who visited Mecca this year. And news of the deaths at this year's pilgrimage has particular poignancy for him. His own aunt died from heat exhaustion during a previous pilgrimage.
When I was growing up in Saudi Arabia, you know, in the 80s, my dad made it a habit to try to go to Hajj as many times as he could. And he would take us with him. And I don't remember exactly which year it was, but my aunt, she came to visit and to perform Hajj with us. And at that time in the 80s, we were allowed to take private cars in. And I just have this vivid memory of my aunt sitting inside our Suburban in the extreme heat. And just her face is so red and struggling to breathe. And I can tell she wasn't doing too well. But then the adults, you know, that were with us, you know, took her away. I'm sure rushed her to some emergency center close by or something. And I never saw her after that. So that was the day she passed away, and she's buried in Mecca. This year is my latest Hajj, and due to some poor planning on our group, we ended up having to walk after throwing the stones ritual after the day of Arafah. And, you know, my wife and my daughter, we had to walk really long distances just because the traffic wasn't moving, so many people that you're trying to navigate around. And it was in an extreme, you know, obviously sun and heat. And I just remember my wife, I saw her face and I kind of remembered my aunt's face, and I was starting to get worried, but we finally got to the bus that we were trying to get to, and it was an air-conditioned bus. And as soon as she got in there, just laid down in the back seat of the bus and trying to catch her breath and rest. And I was starting to look around to see if there's some sort of a clinic or a medical facility close by. Even if we needed to call someone to come and help us, you know, it would have been really hard for emergency workers to come in due to the large crowd. So that was definitely an unpleasant memory. But at the same time, you know, for my aunt, for someone's life to end at that moment, you know, because in our belief, if you perform the Hajj in the proper way, right at the day of Arafah, you know, that's the main event. You come back with a clean slate. All your sins are wiped. And if your Hajj is accepted by God, right, by our Creator, what could be better than that, right? Obviously, nobody wants to end their life in any bad way, but just gives us a little bit of positive aspect to it for those who end up dying. But yeah, it's just the extreme heat kind of brought some of that memory back, and it wasn't a pleasant thing.
Ahmed, as you told that story, including your wife's experience, I want to bring in another of our guests, Angelica, because you were 8 months pregnant with your third child when you went on pilgrimage. Tell us about that experience, please.
So my husband and I had moved to Saudi Arabia because we were teachers and we wanted to have the experience of living near Mecca and Medina, and my husband's family had done import-export. It had always been his dream to live there. So we were both teaching English in Saudi Arabia, and the opportunity to make Hajj came. It was not the most opportune time because I was 8 months pregnant, but as any Muslim will tell you, once you get an opening to go to Hajj, that is an invitation from Allah, so you have to take it. I had made Umrah multiple times before. I had moved to Saudi Arabia from Phoenix, Arizona, so I was used to the heat, and it was in November, so it wasn't too bad. I took a lot of provisions. I made sure to have a back brace, an extra pillow, and the experience as a pregnant woman was actually what magnified my Hajj, because when I was on the pilgrimage, I remembered the story of our mother Hajar and her search for water for Zamzam, and walking back and forth, I was able to gain strength from that story. I also got a lot of support from fellow pilgrims. Some people paid for a wheelchair for me when it was too far for me to walk. There are a lot of people who would say, mashallah, when I passed by them, because you know, I was very, very full. So it was something that definitely enriched my experience, despite some unfortunate things that also happened.
Are you able to say what those were?
It's an unfortunate reality that's not discussed very often, but there are a lot of women who are sexually assaulted during both the lesser and the major pilgrimage, Umrah and Hajj. It's something that caught me off guard when I first experienced it on my second Umrah, when I was groped from behind. And when it first happens, you don't really know that that's what's happening, because in my mind, I'm thinking that this is a place that people are coming to strictly for worship. That's the only thing you go to Mecca for. There was no way that I could fathom that someone would risk soiling their spiritual experience by groping. But it happened again, and Luckily, I was with my husband, so I tied a drawstring bag around my waist and shifted it so that my shoes would be in the back of me just to avoid being groped again, but it really shook me. Unfortunately, that experience was repeated on the next Umrah that I made. And in talking to my husband's aunt, she said that this was something that was unfortunate that happened a lot. She was a part of the Ghanaian consulate, the Hajj Commission. So she had made Hajj many times. And she told me when I'm making my tawaf or I'm in any space that's really crowded, because I'm tall, I'm almost 6 feet tall, she told me to hold my elbows out and to just create space.
Did that work?
When I made Hajj, it worked to some degree, but when people are intent on doing something wrong, they find ways to do it. It was something that I just became hyper vigilant about. And unfortunately, it was something that soiled my experience on Umrah at times. The good thing about making Hajj, though, was my husband never left my side, but he would often stand in front of me to protect my belly. But it was unfortunate that I had to spend so much of my time in the tawaf when I should be devoting that time to prayer. I was hypervigilant about people who might seek to violate the space that I had created for myself.
I would imagine soon after the Hajj you performed in 2012, your third child was born. Do you tell them much about that pilgrimage that they were on as an unborn child?
Yes, I have four children. Yeah. And those are her bragging rights. My daughter, I gave her the middle name Hajar because of the pilgrimage. And she loves to tell her siblings that she's the only one who made Hajj in mommy's belly.
Let's bring in our third guest, who's also called Ahmed. This Ahmed is based in Kenya. You're a consultant pathologist in Nairobi, and you've performed the Hajj several times and the Umrah as well to Mecca. You did so once at a time of COVID. What was that like?
You remember in 2020, they closed it completely. Then in 2021, when they opened, I was fortunate enough to be among the first people to come do Umrah. And it was almost heavenly. I mean, it was completely empty. Everywhere you are going, you are getting VIP treatment, no crowding at all. At the Haram, unfortunately, we couldn't really get to the Kaaba because it was closed off. There was social distancing, and everywhere you're going, there was no crowding at all. On one hand, it was quite nice because you had all the space, you could really concentrate. Definitely, there was no groping at that time. And I can identify what Angelica is saying because it has happened to my wife as well in the past. I mean, literally, people groping women as they are trying to touch the Kaaba or doing the tawaf around it. Someone might get away with it because there is congestion, but sometimes you actually find there's no crowding and the guy is really pressing on the women, and literally I had to stand behind my wife as we do the tawaf and tell people. But I must say this year and last year, since COVID, they have introduced some certain measures. For example, only men wearing the loincloth are allowed to go down to the mataf where we do the tawaf. So that has kind of added some bit of discipline. But comparing what we had in Umrah during the COVID and now, it's not as spiritual as you get it now, but at the same time, the crowding really gets into you. So it's a give and take. There are many, many Muslims, billions of them in the world. So I started my first Umrah in 2014 and then Hajj, and every year it gets better and better, I must say.
Ahmed, you made reference to the experiences that your wife had, those unfortunate experiences that Angelica, our other guest, had. And wherever groping happens in the world, it's a crime.
Yes.
There's no other way to see it. But I wonder, for groping to happen in a place that is so spiritual and so sacred for your faith, does that make it worse?
There'll always be idiots and criminals. We pray for them that they get hidayah and they get guidance. But I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes, somebody literally stealing in Haram. So it's a thief. He's actually stealing from somebody's bag right in front of us. I've seen women being groped and the policemen are trying to like push the men away. So I think in those kind of environments, just even this Hajj, people fight. People get into really a fist fight because of emotions and anger. So I think this kind of crowd dynamics can really bring the worst in certain people, also bring out the best in certain people. Yeah. So it's human nature, but ultimately it's every person to themselves, and all of us will be accountable before Allah for our actions. Yeah.
It is really sad to hear some of these experiences. I can't even imagine actually this is happening, but I happen to have my wife and my 18-year-old daughter with me on this trip, who are actually with me listening on the call right now. It's really interesting that we've had this conversation, because I personally, as a man, I prefer when I do my tawaf is to go down to the lowest level as close as I can to the Kaaba. Part of it is because I want to be able to try to touch the building itself as part of the ritual. You know, we're encouraged to try to touch one of the corners, not the black stone. I mean, obviously, we're encouraged to do the black stone, but just because of the crowd, it's really, really difficult. But I do see what the other guests are talking about in terms of people pushing and shoving and so on. And I just want to clarify, I think they would agree. And, you know, this is absolutely not part of the ritual. And the whole religion, it aspires to achieve, you know, perfection, right? Or we're encouraged to do ihsan, which is, you know, try to reach the perfect level. But we can never sit here on your show and say that all Muslims are perfect. Imperfect people also get through and, you know, attend and do things that they're not supposed to do. But I had this exact conversation with my 18-year-old daughter who wanted to come down with me. And I told her that, okay, no problem. We can do that. And I've done it before with my family, but like Brother Ahmed from Kenya also says that, and the sister also mentioned her husband, we end up becoming kind of a little bit of a guard, right? Because we're trying to protect the women with us, not just from any kind of activity, but it's just that space makes it really difficult. I've also had the last Umrah, I've had an experience where my wife, my three daughters and I were walking around on the second level of the Haram in Mecca. And we noticed that there was a person kind of following them around and did not make them very comfortable. I immediately grabbed one of the guards and I pointed out to him, and he immediately went and basically was able to talk to this person. And I don't know what they did, but they removed him or made sure that he understands he's not allowed to do that.
I think that's something they really need to encourage, to have more security personnel, more people overseeing things. And I agree with Brother Ahmed from the US that anybody can report anything at any time. And in a situation like that, the more people you have, the more comfortable people will be.
Ahmed's from Kenya, Angelica in the United States, and the other Ahmed, who's based in the US but is originally from Saudi Arabia. We'll hear more of that conversation in just a moment. I'm James Reynolds. You're listening to BBC OS Conversations on Hajj from the BBC World Service.
Beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig. Schon probiert? Den legendären Big Mac gibt's jetzt in zwei weiteren Varianten. Den Double Big Mac für den doppelten Genuss und den Big Mac Bacon TS mit knusprigem Bacon. Nur für kurze Zeit und nur bei McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. In allen teilnehmenden Restaurants, nur solange der Vorrat reicht.
You may have been surprised, perhaps even shocked, to hear some of the behaviour encountered by the pilgrims at Hajj we spoke to. But of course, we mustn't forget that for millions of Muslims, it is an intensely positive experience. Saudi Arabia, for its part, will also point to the increased safety measures it has introduced in recent years. So let's pick up our conversation by returning firstly to Angelica to hear a little bit more about her route to the Hajj and how it has had a major lasting impact on her life.
I converted to Islam at the age of 23, and I'm still the only Muslim in my family. And it's still hard for me to believe that Allah allowed me to make Hajj. It's such a blessing every time I remember the fact that I was actually on Hajj. I'm filled with a strong sense of love, a recommitment to my faith, and also a very deep responsibility. As Ahmed noted, you know, this is something that Muslims dream for their whole lives. There were elders who were a part of our Hajj group who had literally saved for 40 years to be able to make Hajj. The experience made me feel closer to God, more firm in my faith, and also a lot more patient, understanding that Hajj is for everyone, the perfect and the imperfect. And perhaps I am one of the most imperfect. And it made me just really remember how blessed I am to be a part of a faith that is accommodating of everyone, that is so enriching. And every year I get emotional around Hajj time because I also have my daughter who I can look at. And as she grows, she is a reminder of the importance of Islam, the importance of raising good Muslim daughters, and the importance of being a strong Muslim woman.
I have a very religious wife, alhamdulillah. She's really like sort of my guiding star, really pushes me kind of quietly. But in 2014, she decided, let's go do Umrah. So we came for Umrah early in the year, like 3 months before Ramadan. So when you did the Umrah, I'd heard a lot about the Hajj and Umrah. My grandmother, we come from a very poor background in Kibra, in Nairobi, in a slum area. So when I came for the Umrah, it's like it blew my mind open. And it's one of those experiences you can never explain. The first time, it just kind of washed everything away, changed my perspective of life. And we made the intention that we wanted to come back for Hajj. Somehow we got the money, and a few months later we came back for Hajj that year. And I made an intention after that every 5 years I'll want to come for Hajj, which I've managed to. And I also made an intention that every year I'll come for Umrah, and I managed to bring my family. But the thing is, really, for lack of better words, coming for Umrah, coming for Hajj is a serious detox. You get spiritual detox, physical detox. Every time you come for Umrah, every time you come for Hajj, you go back, you're a different person. And it literally becomes addictive, something that you really yearn for. We're very fortunate in Kenya that we are close to Saudi Arabia, so flights are not that expensive, and we don't have many people coming for pilgrim, unfortunately, so we tend to get good opportunities. I know other people, for example, they might have the money, they might not even get the opportunity from Indonesia, Singapore, because of the quota system that they have. So to actually come for Hajj is a big, big blessing. There are many people who have the money and they're not able to come, so it's a really, really big privilege, and we keep praying that we're able to come back as often as possible, and for our brothers and sisters to be able to come as well, inshallah.
You've described that experience as addictive, and I wonder, our other Ahmed, based in the United States, you've performed the Hajj pilgrimage more times than you can remember. How does the experience change every time you do it?
Yeah, I hear similar things from other people to what I heard from the other guests, Angelica and Ahmed from Kenya, about people who came in for that one time. For me, you know, growing up here, as I said, my dad, you know, brought us several times. You know, as an adult, I remember at least four, maybe five times where I came on my own, and I completely agree with the word. You get hooked, you get addicted to it, and it's because maybe it's not the life-changing experience or the life-changing change every time, but for me, it's about the incremental, right? It's about getting better after every trip and focusing on what can I get better, what can I improve in my life, and doing, you know, the little things, right? Now, I'm blessed. As a small business owner in the United States, you know, I'm trying my best to come in multiple times a year. I came last time in 2022. We skipped 23. We're here in 24. But my intention moving forward, something about this trip here that made me really put attention that, you know, as Sister Angelica said, you know, you get invited. So I'm going to continue to ask for an invitation. And if I get invited, even with all the challenges, with all the things that we've been talking about and the difficulties and so on, I believe you would get the same answer. Every single Muslim who would get an opportunity would still do this, even though we're, you know, really required to do it once in a lifetime. But the Prophet, peace be upon him, was asked by someone in his audience, he said, how many times should we come to Hajj? And the Prophet stayed silent. And the guy asked again, how many times should we come to Hajj? He stayed silent three times. And afterwards, the Prophet answered. He told him, if I told you you should come every year, it would have been an obligatory thing and no one would be able to do it. So the required is once. But just from the questioning and the response of the Prophet, it tells you that if he could have said come every year, maybe he would have. But that would be too much for many, many people. So we're required to do one. And for many people, it is a life-changing experience. I was asking kind of my daughter, who's 18 years old, and that was her first time. And one of the stories she told me, she was sitting with some other sisters in the Haram, or I think it was in Mina, in Medina. Somebody was asking her, was like, how old are you? You're 18? And she was like, wow, you're so blessed. You see this other woman here? She's 85 years old. That's her first time. And my daughter was reflecting on that, saying that, she's glad she came to do it early. She wants to encourage other young people to try to do it early. It is a difficult trip, but come do it early, and maybe, inshallah, you'll get other opportunities later in your adult life to get that incremental improvement after each one of the trips that you're blessed with. What can you change? What can you do better? And I was telling another CEO of a small business that we've invested in before I came here about, hey, I'm about to go to Hajj, and I was surprised. I didn't know this, but there are so many other pilgrimages around the world. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go do this pilgrimage in the Europe. I don't know. There's one called Camino or El Camino or something. I heard about it.
Yeah, Santiago de Compostela, I think, in Spain.
Yeah. And I was reading more about that. I was like, wow, this is incredible. I mean, people around the world are going for these different trips, searching for purpose, searching for improvement, reflection. And I can't think of any event in the world where you get millions of people, millions, trying to do the same thing. And with all the challenges, with heat, crowds, pushing and shoving, we would do it in a heartbeat over and over again.
Ahmed's from Saudi Arabia, now living in the States. Ahmed's in Kenya, the other Ahmed, and also Angelica in the US. We thank each of them for sharing their experiences as pilgrims. I'm James Reynolds. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
Oh, das ist gut. Ich sehe was, was du nicht siehst, und das ist blau.
Boah, Papa, das ist ja einfach. Da, diese blaue Ladesäule da.
Oder die da.
Und da hinten, da ist auch noch eine.
Das ist ja gut.
Lade jetzt schnell an über 2500 Aral-Pulse-Ladepunkten beim Connect-Testsieger mit dem besten Ladenetz Deutschlands. Bestell dafür einfach deine neue Ladekarte in der Aral-Pulse-App. Willkommen bei Aral-Pulse. Mehr Informationen zum Connect-Test auf aralpulse.de.